A blue sign hurtles through space toward a green planet. Turner. Now, a logo of a thick-maned lion framed by a ring of film. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. In a black-and-white film, a coat of arms appears, bearing a knight's visor. Titles fly toward us. Lana Turner as Georgia Lorison and Kirk Douglas as Jonathan Shields. With Walter Pidgeon, Dick Powell, Barry Sullivan, Gloria Graham, and Gilbert Roland. In The Bad and the Beautiful. Copyright 1952, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Produced by Lowe's Incorporated. Screenplay by Charles Schnee, based on a story by George Bradshaw. Music by David Raxon. Produced by John Houseman. Directed by Vincent Minnelli. Now, a telephone table stands beside a wardrobe closet. In the shadows, a man answers the phone.
Stage 5. Well, Mr. Engel's on the camera boom rehearsing right now.
On a soundstage, a movie director sits on a crane 20 feet above the floor. The camera boom sweeps down toward an actress who lies on her back under bright lights.
Very nice.
Say, honey, could you put that other hand up around your throat?
An assistant brings over the phone.
Telephone, Mr. Emil. Transatlantic, Paris. Jonathan Shields calling you.
Who?
Jonathan Shields.
Fred Emil hands the phone back.
Bring the boom back to one.
I'm sorry, Mr. Emil just left.
Now a maid answers a call.
Hello? Yes. Who? One moment, please. Miss Georgia.
Yes, Ida.
It's Paris, France. It's him.
I can't hear you.
It's Mr. Jonathan. Jonathan Shields.
I still can't hear you.
Miss Lorison is out.
Wearing a velvet evening gown, Georgia Lorison drapes a netted veil over her platinum blonde hair.
I don't know where.
She sidles over to an extension phone, picks up the receiver, and listens in, smiling slightly to herself. Elsewhere, a man works in his study.
Hello. What? Talk a little louder, will you please? There's a bad connection.
He holds a pipe in his teeth.
Yes, this is James Lee Barlow. Harris?
Mr. Shields? Oh. Is Mr. Shields paying for this call? Put him on. Hello, Jonathan?
Drop dead.
Now, in the darkness, a car's headlights shine on an iron gate, decorated with a coat of arms. Above a plumed knight's helmet, a sign reads, Shields Pictures Incorporated. Then the motto, Non sans droit. The car pulls onto the studio lot and approaches an office building, where one light shines in an upper window. A chauffeur opens the rear door for the pipe-smoking writer, James Lee Bartlow, the blonde Georgia Lorison, and the film director, Fred Emil. As they walk to the building, Georgia stops beside another Shields coat of arms. With an eyebrow pencil, she draws a cartoonish mustache on the knight's visor. She laughs, takes Fred's arm, and heads inside. In the upstairs office, a gray-haired executive fidgets while he waits. He draws two leather chairs closer to his desk, then sits behind it and taps his fingers together. His office's wide double doors open, and a secretary brings in his guests. Their merry faces sober when they enter.
Hello.
Hi, Harry.
Harry, how are you?
Well,
Georgia.
Harry.
She kisses his cheek.
You know, in the 5 years since my 60th birthday, I've been kissed by more beautiful women than in all the years before. That's something you youngsters wouldn't know anything about, isn't it?
Georgia wanders over to a framed caricature on the wall. In the drawing, a sour-faced man with horns and pointed ears wields a sword.
Good to see you, Jim. You know, you can always tell a successful author by a cashmere jacket.
Across the room, five Academy Awards stand on display. Fred reads the name on one of the Oscar statuettes. At Harry's desk, Jim finds a piece of stationery and begins folding it.
Jim, congratulations on your Pulitzer, whatever they call it, prize.
Thanks, Harry.
Caught your picture the other night, Fred. Great as usual.
Thank you, Harry.
And you, my pretty one, you really made me cry.
He pats George's cheek.
Now then, have I flattered you enough? If so, here's why I asked you to come here in the middle of the night. Why, Jonathan called you today. Jimmy told me that you told him to drop dead. Is that Pulitzer language?
James Lee never wrote a better line.
Well, here it is. After 2 years, Jonathan's ready to produce a picture. He wants you to write it, you to direct, and you to star. Now, on the name Jonathan Shields, it's impossible to raise 5 cents. But on Fred Emil, Georgia Lawrence, James Lee Bartle, I can raise $2 million by tomorrow noon.
Jim cuts the folded paper.
Not going to beg you to say yes. I've had 2 years of begging for Jonathan, and that's enough. I know you'll never work with him again. But he can't seem to get it through his head. Please, a favor to me, not to him. Will you give me your answer while I get him on the phone?
Jim and Fred look to Georgia, who nods.
Good.
Harry turns on an intercom.
Get me the transatlantic operator. Tell her we're ready to talk with Jonathan Shields in Paris as soon as she can get him.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
He turns back to his guests.
I know you'll never work with him again, and I don't blame you. Why should you? You've done enough for him already. And vice versa, maybe. Fred, you know him first. You must have known him for what? 15 or 16?
18 years. 18 years ago, at that funeral, that guy standing next to me, how was I supposed to know who he was?
We are met, my friends.
In a cemetery, mourners gather before a coffin. Fred Emil stands in front beside a man wearing a trench coat. The stranger's wavy blonde hair is combed back from his hard face. His dark eyes gaze blankly at the coffin.
Hugo Shield, one of the pioneers who built our great motion picture industry.
One of the madmen who almost wrecked it.
Fred mutters from the side of his mouth.
An artist who created in a new medium.
A butcher who sold everything but the pig's whistle.
The stranger beside him forces down a queasy swallow.
He will never be forgotten.
After the service, the blonde man hands
Stay
out cash.
You'll get your dough.
Waiting in a line, the funeral goers collect their pay. A man in front of Fred takes two bills.
Thank you, Mr. Shields.
Fred stiffens.
You're Shields?
You were hired to give a performance. $11 to act like a mourner. You didn't do your job, you don't get paid. Next. Next.
Shields deals out the money to his extras. Later, Fred steps out of a convertible.
That afternoon, I drove into the Hollywood Hills. I just had to, I guess.
He trots up a mansion's front walk. A trim man with dark hair and a thick mustache, Fred wears a suit and fedora. He paces outside the home's arched mission-style doors. Jonathan Shields answers, his trench coat draped over his shoulders.
It's me, Big Mouth.
Did you come for a fight or for your 11 bucks?
The things I said at the funeral, they were childish and cheap. I'm sorry.
Wait a minute.
Huh? What is it?
You in the business?
Yeah.
What do you do?
Oh, a little bit of everything. Assistant director on Poverty Row, 4 day quickies. Sold a couple of story ideas. Weed, I work as an extra. I do a little stunt work. What I aim to be is a director.
What's stopping you?
Well, I know I can direct better than most of the hacks that I work for. Trouble is, when it comes to selling myself, you know, telling people how good I am, I get tongue-tied. Not so tongue-tied with you.
You are looking for a job, hmm?
Yeah.
So am I. Come on in.
In the mansion's entrance hall, a stepladder stands on the marble floor. Jonathan takes Fred into a parlor where broken drinking glasses stand on a bar counter.
My father died last year, I'd be a millionaire. A year from now, he'd have put up a new studio for me to inherit. But this was the year, so I don't have a dime.
Who paid for the crowd at the funeral?
Well, that was the last of the cash. If he lived in a crowd, I couldn't let him be buried alone.
Finding one glass undamaged, he pours Fred a drink, then fills a cracked beer stein for himself. Fred straightens a photo of a sour-faced man on the wall. Jonathan touches the stein to Fred's glass, and they drink. Fred keeps staring at the photo.
Oh, the best legal counsel advised me to change my name.
Because the town thought your father was a heel?
Jonathan glares for a second, then softens. Shrugging, he sits at a window seat.
He wasn't a heel. He was the heel. We couldn't stand living in the same town together, but I liked him a lot. He made great pictures. So will I.
You haven't got much to begin with.
No, he brought me up to start at the top. Say, how do you start at the bottom?
Are you going to change your name?
Change it? I'm going to ram the name of Shields down their throats.
His beer stein bears a knight's helmet design.
Where are you living?
Well, until they kick me out, this is my bed and board.
Come on.
Fred picks up a packed suitcase and carries it to the parlor door. Jonathan goes to get his hat from the bar.
Oh, by the way, my name is Fred Emuel.
Hi.
Hi.
The two men shake hands. On his way out, Jonathan goes back for the beer stein.
18 years ago, living was cheap in this town, but jobs were sky high. Particularly if your name was Shields. Some days we'd hit with a quickie or a western on Poverty Row and eat well.
On a movie set, an Indian ambushes a cowboy. Fred crouches nearby, directing the scene while a cameraman films it. At the end of the take, bare-chested Jonathan hauls equipment for the next set.
And some nights we played. We crashed only the very best parties.
Now, on a terrace, Fred and Jonathan peer into a room where men and women mill around wearing evening clothes. They walk in, accompanied by a dark-haired young woman and a man with a bristly crew cut, and pass a portly director. Fred holds his date's hand as they move toward a jazz combo. A singer sits on a piano bench and stares ahead with a disaffected gaze. Jonathan notices a Latin movie star with a woman on his lap and points him out to his friends. Jonathan and Fred break off to mingle. Behind them, a woman holds the rapt attention of a circle of guests. As a waiter brushes by them, Jonathan takes a sandwich from his full tray. Jonathan and Fred follow the waiter to a back room and discover several older men engaged in a poker game. Middle-aged Harry Pebble smokes from a cigarette holder.
Full house, and you can't have four of a kind. No, that could never happen.
Not even in one of your B pictures. Harry, I think you're bluffing.
Put up or shut up.
Money talks, and I've got money. I raise you 500.
Right back at you.
Five, and five more.
Jonathan looks at the mound of poker chips on the card table.
Harry, when did you begin to tell the truth? Don't tell me today. What's time today?
And blame all your charms.
Later, the party crashers drive home in Fred's convertible. Fred's date, Kay, and the crew-cutted Sid Murphy sing, while Jonathan dozes in the front seat. Sid peeks under the hat covering Jonathan's face.
You know, that Harry Pebble's a great poker player.
Yeah.
But my father could beat him every time, and I could always beat my father.
Now, to get in a game like that, all I need is a few...
You're crazy.
No, I mean it. All I need is a few $100 for my first stack of chips.
What's a few $100 to raise when four substantial citizens pool their resources?
Later, a pawnbroker turns down Jonathan's coat. The friends all look at Sid, who sighs and hands over his watch.
Came the dawn.
Now, the convertible stands outside a private club. As Fred sleeps in the back seat with his arm around Kay, Jonathan comes out with two men.
Good night, gentlemen.
Good night.
He wears a big grin.
Jonathan, how much you win?
His three friends lean toward him with eager smiles.
Hey. 500.
750.
1,000.
More than that. 6,000.
Jonathan!
I lost. To be exact, I lost $6,351.
Who won?
Harry Pebble.
Harry Pebble?
Later, in Pebble's office.
Harry, I admit it. I lost the money and I owe it to you. I wish I could pay you, Harry.
I know it's breaking your heart.
I could give you an IOU.
Yeah, and what would I do with it?
You don't run this studio, Harry, but you are an executive producer. Beat Pictures, it's true.
They make money.
You have four producers in your unit, why not five? If you put me on, say, at $300 a week, I could pay you off slowly but surely. $6,351.
All right, you got the job.
I thought so.
He lights a cigarette.
Oh, so you're a genius boy, huh? You think you blackmailed me.
Harry, that's a horrid word.
Well, get this. My unit turns out 18 pictures a year. I cry for ideas. If you'd have sweat out a story for me the way you sweat out losing that $6,351, I'd have hired you anyway. Why didn't you come to me in the first place? What are you, proud?
I tried to see you, Harry. I couldn't get in.
Do you know who gave me my first job?
My father.
Yes, and you're just like him. Got to angle everything the cute way.
Look, I'll pay you off $100 a week.
I wouldn't take a dime. Just bring me a picture I can shoot, genius boy.
You're all right, Harry. One day you work for me.
Get me Joe Clarendon in publicity.
Meanwhile, I need an office with a desk for my assistant.
Nighttime on the beach. Jonathan sculpts two knights' helmets out of sand.
Shields, aim you.
Kay sits with them by a bonfire.
That's a big dream, Jonathan.
If you dream, dream big.
Meanwhile, children, beginning this week, you'll be drawing a modest check each and every Thursday. It's time you two made it legal.
Tell him he's crazy, Kay.
You're crazy.
Tell him I'm not.
He's not.
Oh, I just happened to have a ring with me. Sid Murphy knows a friend who knows a jeweler.
Jonathan holds a ring box.
Shall we?
Tell him yes, Kay.
She grabs Jonathan's dimpled cheeks and kisses him.
He said to tell me yes.
A breeze stirs Kay's curly hair. She gazes tenderly at Fred, lying on the sand, then leans down and kisses his lips.
Hey, she says yes very nicely.
Now, a tower of movie scripts.
In the next few years, Jonathan Shields produced 11 pictures for Harry Pebble. B pictures. I directed the third and five more after that. We weren't really picture makers. We were second-hand dealers. But we learned our trade. Then one cloudy day, Harry Pebble assigned us a little horror called The Doom of the Catmen.
In wardrobe.
This the sort of thing you had in mind? Of course, they need freshening up. They've been hanging for quite a while.
I can't get into this thing.
Don't worry about it. If they don't turn around too much, a little muslin here will cover it up fine. This is a matter of fitting. We take care of that. We have a whole department for that. This may be a problem, unless you get a thinner man. You see, this material is imported. We can't get it anymore. But don't let that be an obstacle. Here, the perfect fit. This will give you the full effect. You see, lots of character in the tail, plenty of fright. Need a little puffing up, but it'll be all right. Of course, you got to visualize it in the lights. You got to use your imagination. Shoulder pads. Straighten it right out. This'll give you the effect. It'll be good.
Jonathan and Fred stare at five actors clad in droopy plush cat costumes with papier-mâché heads. Later, in a screening room, they slump in the front row of theater seats. Jonathan kicks off his shoes, then turns to Fred.
Suppose we...
Scowling, they look away. Jonathan jumps to his feet and crosses the narrow room. A bare light bulb throws his shadow onto the wall.
Look, put five men dressed like cats on the screen. What do they look like?
Like five men dressed like cats.
When an audience pays to see a picture like this, what do they pay for?
To get the pants scared off them.
And what scares the human race more than any other single thing?
Jonathan presses a light switch, and darkness fills the room.
The dark.
Of course. And why? Because the dark has a life of its own. In the dark, all sorts of things come alive.
Suppose we never do show the catmen.
Is that what you're thinking?
Exactly.
No catmen.
All right. Now, what do we put on the screen that'll make the backs of their necks crawl?
Two eyes, shining in the dark.
A dog, frightened, growling, showing its fang.
A bird, its neck broken, feathers torn from its throat.
A little girl screaming, claw marks down her cheeks.
Later on the set, Fred coaches a little girl dressed as an urchin.
Cut!
He scoops the child into his arms
okay,
and kisses
boys,
her.
New deal, wrap it up. Come on, get that boom back.
This is my first stop. Okay, I'm going to give you a
The night of the sneak preview, Harry Pebble still hadn't seen the picture. Jonathan and I had made sure of that.
Now, Fred and a film editor dash across the studio grounds, their arms loaded with film cans. Jonathan and Sid hustle them into their cars and speed away. At a movie theater, a banner reads, Major Studio Preview Tonight, above a marquee for Anna Karenina. Movie patrons form a line in front of a box office kiosk. Harry Pebble runs out to the street to meet the approaching studio car. Clutching the film to their chests, Fred and the editor run to the theater doors, then an usher points them upstairs to the projection room. Inside, they dump the canisters on a table and sort them out. The projectionist grabs a reel and loads it on. In the lobby, movie patrons file through into the theater. Jonathan waits by the usher stand and rubs his hand over his dimpled chin. Upstairs, the projectionist turns on the machine's lamp, and Fred slumps with relief against the wall. Later, outside, Jonathan stands by a portable counter beneath a sign which reads, Please fill out cards with your comments. The theater doors fly open. Teenagers swarm out and grab response cards. One girl shows her friend her comment, It stinks. Later.
It stinks, 1. Fair, 8. Good, 24. Very good, 47. Say, we've never had cards like this before.
Give us more like this one.
Excellent, 34. Outstanding, 17.
Oh, boy, wait till I fly sneeze around the executive dining room. That'll show.
Harry takes the cards.
Be at my office at 10 in the morning sharp. I'll give you your next assignment. You did all right on this one, genius boy.
Look, I did better than all right. I did a great job of producing. Tell them that in the executive dining room. Oh, and when you do, remember, the name Shields is not spelled P-E-B-B-E-L.
I don't want to give you too much credit. Just enough to make you hungry for more.
Harry and Sid leave smiling. Behind the writing counter, Fred and Jonathan trade a wide-eyed look.
Say, by the way, my name is spelled A-M-I-E-L.
Huh?
I was thinking of taking a small bow myself. A small bow? That never helped anybody. Get this straight, Fred. We're building the name Shields. Shields Productions. That's the name we're going to ram down their throats. And it's big enough for both of us.
Yeah, I know, Jonathan.
Look what we did on this one. We took a 5-cent story, a 10-cent budget, and a 2-cent leading man, and we put it over. Yes, sir. We're getting to know our business, son.
Yes, Mother.
Come on. Let's go back and get my car.
Later, on the road.
You know, Fred, when I work on a picture, it's like romancing a girl. You see her, you want her, you go after her. The big moment. Then the letdown. Every time, every picture, the after picture boost.
No worry. Someday you'll learn to love him and leave him.
Think so?
Jonathan cuts a hard left.
Where you going? Why are you turning off here?
This you gotta see.
As night falls, Jonathan drives to a sprawling wooden home at the end of a dirt road. Scraggly weeds grow up the front wall, where a sign reads, For Sale or Rent, home of the late George Lorison.
Crow's nest. George Lorison built this.
before he died.
I wouldn't have missed it for anything. Can we go home now?
Jonathan pushes open the gate. Inside the house, they pass a suit of armor and a display of antique knives.
So this is how actors used to live, huh? Cheerful little place, isn't it? Now, if we can just find out where he keeps the boiling oil.
Jonathan shines a flashlight past Fred into another room.
The rumpus room.
It's set up like a ship's cabin with tables and chairs.
Jonathan. Jonathan, will you please tell me what we're doing here? You scouting a location?
Yeah, sure, that's it. For our next Harry Pebble production. It could be the Batman fly again. Well, how about Mama Vampire and her three little bloodsuckers? We don't even have to show the little...
Jonathan finds a wall scrawled with cartoonish drawings and doodles. One sour-faced caricature has horns and pointed ears.
Larson's idea, my old man.
Larson's last three pictures were for my father.
He cuts it off the wallpaper.
He gave me my first drink when I was 13. My first cigar at 14. And when I was 15, he taught me the facts of life.
In a publicity still, handsome George Lorison poses with a Great Dane.
He was a great actor. And a great man.
He was a rat and a drunk.
Up in the ceiling, a girl's legs hang down from a ledge, showing her rolled-up dungarees and white tennis shoes.
Who are you?
His daughter.
I didn't know he had one. What are you doing up there?
Oh, get out.
A rat and a drunk. What kind of a way is that to talk about your father?
Well, he was my father. Now, will you shut up and leave me alone? Go on, blow.
Somebody ought to tan your rear.
The girl throws down a rope ladder.
You want to try it?
She pulls it back up before Jonathan can grab it.
I changed my mind. Now, will you get out of here? Go on, get out!
She stays hidden in the dark ceiling alcove. Fred leaves, and Jonathan stays behind a moment. Standing under a carved stranger's welcome sign, he stares at the girl's slender, pale legs. Jonathan glances around the rustic room, sadly shakes his head, and leaves.
The next morning, Jonathan received the news of our next assignment.
Did you see Harry?
Jonathan lies on a couch, smoking a cigarette.
Well, what's our next picture?
The caricature of Jonathan's father hangs in a frame.
Get a good grip on yourself. You ready?
Uh-huh.
Our next picture will be the son of the Catman.
Fred stiffens. His gaze wanders away, then hardens again.
That settles it.
He throws a weathered book onto Jonathan's desk.
The time has come.
Farley Mountain. It's a great book. Three studios tried to lick it and couldn't.
Well, I can.
He shows Jonathan a bound notebook.
There's my outline, scene for scene.
Well, you know what Harry Pebble will say.
Yeah. Look, I've told you 100 times, genius boy. I don't want to win awards. I want to make pictures
that end with a kiss and black ink on the books.
Jonathan. Jonathan, this is my baby. I found it and I licked it. I've been nursing it along till I was sure that we could handle it. Well, now I'm sure. Remember what you said last night? Well, we've practiced long enough. It's time we made one for real. Of course, it should be made on a $1 million budget, and it cries to be shot on location down in Veracruz. But you producing and me directing, we can make it on a Harry Pebble budget and still do it right.
You know, for a guy who's tongue-tied when he tries to sell himself...
I could always talk to you.
You really want to do this one, don't you, Fred?
I want to direct it so much I can taste it.
All right, let's do it. Let's do it!
Later, Harry throws down the tattered novel.
I've told you 100 times I don't want to win awards. Give me pictures that end with a kiss and black ink on the books.
I'll make this picture, Harry, or I'll quit.
Jonathan leans forward with a fierce stare.
This is my baby. I found it and I licked it. I want to produce it so much I can taste it. And I'm handing it to you, Harry Pebble, father of the son of the Catman. Do I produce the Faraway Mountain or don't I?
All right, genius boy. You've got it coming to you. Make it and hang yourself.
If you feel that way about it, why don't you fire me and get it over with?
Oh, no. I know the talk around the studio. They say that I need you. That you do all the work and I get all the credit. You think I don't know anything. Well, I know one thing. Every studio in town turned this stinker down. Go ahead. Make it. It'll lay such a bomb that you'll never get another job in this industry. Will I let you produce it? You're on suspension if you don't.
I had thought my Faraway Mountain outline was perfect. After 3 weeks with Jonathan, it was twice as good. We worked day and night. Kay kept the coffee hot and handy. And as Jonathan shaped our material, I saw the birth of what Hollywood later came to call the Shields touch. Jonathan's magic.
Later, in the screening room.
Our toughest problem was a leading man. On a Harry Pebble budget, a top star was out of the question. So I directed tests. A dozen tests. Action.
A screen test shows a blonde woman seated with her back to the camera. An actor enters wearing a Mexican peasant costume.
The great house. Silent, proud, and beautiful. What is it? Are you afraid of me?
Jonathan picks up a phone.
Switch over to the next one.
As a new test starts, another actor faces the woman whose platinum blonde hair curls softly at her shoulders.
So you are Teresa. And I find you just as your brother told me of you, alone in the great house. Proud, silent, and beautiful. What
is it? Who's the girl?
Duvain promised that she could make the test with him.
What did she promise? Who is she?
Judge Lorison's daughter.
Oh. Why didn't you shoot her face?
She was drunk.
Jonathan puffs a cigarette.
This is murder. Sid?
Action.
Let's have that list again.
So you are correct.
You're the director. Pick your poison.
Jonathan. What about Victor Rivera?
Oh, Gaucho?
Why not?
Sure you'd like him. Who wouldn't? Let's have that, mister.
Why can't we get Gaucho?
Because he's a Latin lover, and this is the year for Latin love. The whole town's crying again.
She wouldn't stand a chance. How do we know until we've tried? Maybe you could talk him into it, Jonathan.
Behind them, Sid Murphy leans over Jonathan's shoulder.
Sid, what would appeal to a guy like that?
Gaucho? Yeah.
Sid flips through pages of a little black book. Later, in a nightclub, a mustached Latin actor mambos with a statuesque blonde. She gazes blandly away from him as he cha-chas in a circle around her. Grabbing her in a partner's stance, Gaucho Rivera spins the blonde around. Later, on the street.
I'll try.
Jonathan trots around the front of a rag-top coupe, and Gaucho holds the door open for his date. As she bends low to squeeze into the back seat, Gaucho takes a long look at her ample rear end. At another nightclub, they tango. Gaucho clutches the back of the blonde strapless dress and leads her across the floor. She stares stone-faced at the ceiling. Gaucho presses his cheek to hers.
It would be thrilling.
Near their table, he dips her. Bending her knee stiffly, she lies back in his arms. A waiter brings over a dinner plate, then Gaucho dips the blonde again. She pulls away from him, sits down, and starts to eat. Gaucho dances away by himself.
Jonathan forgot one thing. He forgot he couldn't drink.
Later, Gaucho carries Jonathan home over one shoulder. As he dumps him onto a sofa, the blonde helps herself to a cigarette. Gaucho and Fred look at their unconscious host.
Nice boy. But does he always take on so much altitude?
Well, he's been working night and day for 3 weeks. Besides which, he hardly ever drinks.
He wants me to make a picture.
Yeah.
Then why does he go to all this lovely trouble? I'm a very simple man. I read. What I like, I act. What I do not like, I do not act. Very simple.
Brightening, Fred grabs their movie treatment from a shelf and hands it to Gaucho. The actor takes a pair of glasses from his tuxedo jacket, polishes them with a handkerchief, and sits down with the treatment. Fred leads the statuesque blonde away to a hi-fi and starts up a record on the turntable. She holds up her arms in a rumba pose and dances alone.
A conference was being held in Harry Pebble's office to discuss production plans for the faraway mountain. The suspense was killing me.
Don't worry so much. Yes, Mr. Pebble?
You can go to lunch now.
Thank you. Why don't you take a look in there? I'm sure it doesn't matter.
Now, then, I think I'll stay out here and be a nervous character.
Well, good luck.
Thanks, honey.
As Harry's secretary leaves, the office door opens and Jonathan appears. He exaggerates a relieved slump.
Jonathan. What happened? Didn't they go for Gaucho?
Go for him. He had a hemorrhage. The first time a star ever said he'd shine in a Harry Pebble picture. I'll say this for Harry. He went to bat for us. He slugged it out with the front office. Fred, the faraway mountain's going to be done just the way we want it.
$1 million budget.
We
location in Veracruz. Von Elstein to direct. Gaucho, Wendy for the girl. Ance Chapman for my cameraman. Elstein to direct.
Oh, you're taken care of. Harry agreed. It won't be a separate panel, but your name will be on the screen. Assistant to the producer.
Thanks.
Oh, Fred, you know this story better than anyone else. It's your baby. Look, I want you with me on the set all the time. You don't have to talk to Von Elstein. Any ideas you have, you tell me, and I'll tell him.
Thanks again. Von Elstein to direct.
You always said he was the best in the business.
Sure he is.
Jonathan fixes him in a sober gaze.
I'd rather hurt you now than kill you off forever. You're just not ready to direct $1 million picture.
But you're ready to produce $1 million picture.
With Von Elstein, I am.
You're stealing my picture. It was my idea. I gave it to you.
Without me, it would have stayed an idea.
All right, Jonathan. Let's put it this way. You gave me a word.
So I did.
Harry and Von Elstein.
Jonathan, just got the starting date from the front office. 2 weeks from Monday, you leave for Veracruz. Mr. Von Elstein, I'll get you a reservation a week early.
Right. Mr. Shields, I'll tell you secrets. I don't like producers. But for a man who hands me such a script, eh? For him, it'll be a pleasure to break my iron rule. Today, I shall buy a producer lunch, Mr. Shields. Eh?
Am I included?
By all means, no. Mr. Shields, today I've seen what I thought I would never see. A script prepared by a producer who thinks like a director. For 13 years, I've been making pictures.
Goodbye, Jonathan.
Fred, so long, Fred.
And this is the first time I've found a script I can present exactly as it is. Shot by shot.
Outside his office, Harry lights a cigarette.
Always said the boy was a genius.
He goes back in, leaving Fred with his fists jammed in his pockets. Now, Fred, Georgia, and Jim sit in Harry Pebble's office.
What are you looking at? The Oscar he got for the Faraway Mountain? Oh, I know what you have against Jonathan. And no wonder. Look what he did to you, Fred. He brushed you off his coattails so you had to stand on your own 2 feet. And all you've got in the world is one wife, 6 kids, 2 Academy Awards... and every studio in town after you. Why, Jonathan ruined you. Look what he did to me. I gave him his chance to do the Faraway Mountain. And what does he do? 4 months later, his contract's up, and he walks out of the studio.
He lights up.
And I go right with him.
Georgia looks at the framed caricature.
I know how you feel about him, Georgia. After all, you're a woman. An actress.
The first time I saw Jonathan, I wasn't a woman and I wasn't an actress. The next time I saw him, 5 years later, I wasn't an actress. I was a nothing.
Now, on a soundstage, extras wait on benches. Georgia, wearing an evening gown and rhinestone earrings, strides over to Fred Emil.
What's a wardrobe?
Mr. Emil.
Yeah, what is it, Georgia?
I'm sorry to bother you, but I'd like to sign out early if I could. They're casting a bit at Shields, and if I could get there by 3.
Go ahead. You haven't got much time. Good luck.
Thanks, Mr. Emil. Gus drove me over and waited while I changed. There were few agents in town with fewer clients than Gus. He was the kind of agent who handled only bit players and who never could get into a major producer's office.
At a gas station, Georgia dashes into the restroom. She comes out later wearing a smart business suit.
Gus is still my agent.
He takes Georgia's bag and helps her into the car.
All right, girls, will you come in, please?
Five women, all wearing suits, walk into an office. Standing in line, they face Harry Pebble, Jonathan Shields, and another man who drink coffee and smoke cigarettes.
Well, Mr. Shields, these are the girls for the drugstore, Beth.
How about the newborn baby?
Four here at 3:45.
Jonathan looks at paperwork.
Oh, girls, Mr. Shields, Mr. Pebble, Mr. McDill.
Georgia stands at the far left of the line. Looking around the office, she notices the cartoon of a horned Hugo Shields. Jonathan locks his eyes on her and leans forward.
You're the director. The girl on the end all right with you?
Georgia.
As Georgia turns around, Jonathan puffs out a cloud of smoke. McDill nods.
You're it.
Thank you. All right, girls, would you come with me, please?
Another day on the set. Inside a mock drugstore, Georgia browses a rack of paperbacks. Gaucho Ribera enters.
My call came 2 days later. By then, I'd memorized my one line.
I'll wait.
Turning, Georgia cocks her hip at Gaucho.
Read any good books lately?
Gaucho takes a step toward her. She smiles as he looks her in the eye.
Pat, how was it?
Off stage, Jonathan sits on a stool by the director.
Is that all right with you?
Take it again?
Sure.
Just get another net on the
brain. All right, once again, boy.
As a makeup artist combs Georgia's hair, Jonathan pulls her aside. He murmurs something. Georgia listens intently, nods, then smiles.
All right, here we go.
The actors return to their places, and Jonathan hurries back to his stool.
All right, roll them.
He winks encouragingly at her.
Speed, action.
Dressed in a trench coat, Georgia eyes her paperback with a cool gaze. Gaucho enters the drugstore and drops off a prescription.
I'll wait.
With her eyes still fixed on her book, Georgia slowly turns a page.
Read any good books lately?
Gaucho takes a step toward her. She keeps on reading. As she tilts the book, we see its cover, My Memories of Mexico. Gaucho comes closer and she lifts her eyes.
That?
How was it?
Okay.
Print that.
Jonathan rushes from his stool, ignoring Georgia and heading instead for Gaucho. The two men mutter to each other, then share a laugh and a joking embrace. Later, Georgia walks down a dark apartment hallway. Steadying herself against the stucco wall, she makes her way to a door and opens it.
Your door was unlocked.
Georgia flicks on a lamp and finds Jonathan waiting in an easy chair. She sweeps off her trench coat to reveal a black sequined cocktail dress. Georgia sways as she pours liquor into a paper cup. Harsh lamplight glares against her milky white skin. She downs her drink.
Oh, one day, bitch, you sure expect a lot of company.
For the kind of company you're talking about, I don't have to trot over here at 4 a.m. All I have to do is pick up a phone.
Well, pick one up.
She crushes the cup, then walks into her closet.
You're under contract to Al Cope. Can you hear me?
Yes.
You're under contract, weren't you?
3 years ago. Or 6 months. Until they found out they had another cluck on their hands.
You ever play a real part in a picture?
Last year, I played the lead in a little epic called Jungle Tiger.
I ran it. You played straight man to a chimpanzee. I've been trying to find...
Georgia emerges wearing cotton pajamas. She avoids Jonathan's gaze as she walks past.
Trying to find one decent foot of film on you. Is there any?
She pulls down a Murphy bed.
Now, one line I did for you yesterday.
That was good. But it's not enough to go by.
She turns down her covers.
I want you to make a test for me.
Georgia looks at him across the single bed. Squaring her shoulders, she swaggers over to him, her thick blonde hair curved over one eye. She suddenly sinks into his lap.
All right, Mr. Shields. Isn't this scene supposed to go something like this? I'll make your test for you, and you'll be good to me, and I'll be good to you.
She kisses his forehead, then flips her hair.
Oh, who's kidding who? 4 a.m. It's for the test. I don't want it. It wouldn't be any good anyway. Just a waste of good film.
Going back to the bed, she takes another drink.
But you're a nice-looking guy, and you did go to a lot of trouble. It is getting late, so shall I turn out the light?
Jonathan's face tenses. He gets up from the chair.
You're very generous. Too generous. You're a Lorison, all right.
He starts to leave, then crosses back to the other side of the small apartment, where photos and drawings of George Lorison fill a wall. Records and scrapbooks clutter a sideboard. Jonathan starts a record player nestled among the memorabilia.
The Queen, my lord, is dead. She should have died hereafter. There would have been a time for such a word. Tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted...
Jonathan looks over the photographs of Lorison in numerous roles, a naval officer, a black-robed Hamlet, and a grinning Robin Hood. Georgia frets with a cigarette in her hand.
A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage...
Turn that off and get out. I want to get some sleep.
It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
I said, turn it off. I don't want to hear it. I hate him.
Didn't I say?
Make up your mind. You hate him and you build this shrine to him? He died over 10 years ago and you've been holding your own private wake ever since. You can't be a star in a cemetery.
The time has been my...
Stop pitching. Can't you get it through your head on one girl who doesn't want to be a star?
Because he was a drunk, you're a drunk. Because he loved women, you're a tramp. But you forget one thing. He did it with style.
Jonathan makes a theatrical sweep with his arm. Finding a meerschaum pipe among the clutter, he picks it up.
Put that down.
How many times have you tried to commit suicide?
Twice. I told you to put that pipe down.
Too sacred to touch?
Her panicked frown hardens. She reaches for a paper cup.
Don't waste any sleep over me, Mr. Shields. The last time I tried to commit suicide was 6 months ago. There won't be any next time.
Won't there?
No.
Breath.
People who knew my father give me extra work and a line to say now and then.
Well,
I drink what I want. See who I want.
Queen, my lord.
Who knows? Someday I may even get married.
You should have died hereafter.
To a nice, upright, assistant.
And make him miserable for the rest
tomorrow
of his life.
Tomorrow,
because you're a Lorison, haunted, born to live by make-believe. Look at you. You're acting now, playing the doomed daughter of the great man. Well, let me tell you something. The acting isn't good enough. It's a cheap performance of a bit player, not a star. And that's all it'll ever be until you can pull yourself out of this tomb. Until you can see people as they really are. Yourself as you really are. Until you can do this to your father's picture.
He draws a mustache and beard on it.
Laugh the way he would have laughed. That's not a god talking, Georgia. That's only a man.
Georgia hurls the liquor bottle, then charges him. Jonathan grabs her in a clench and ducks her wild punches.
Miss Lorison!
You better tell her it's all right.
It's all right, Mrs. Curry.
As Jonathan awkwardly smooths Georgia's hair, she weeps onto his sport coat. He scoops her off her feet, and she lies like dead weight in the cradle of his arms. She turns her face from him as he lays her down and straightens the blankets over her. Jonathan crushes her smoldering cigarette and watches Georgia's shoulders heave. Turning away, he steps to the door and switches off the lights.
Good night,
Another day. In a makeup chair, Georgia sits still as an artist draws on thin, arched eyebrows.
It takes 2 hours to get ready for a screen test. 2 very early in the morning hours.
Her agent, Gus, arrives with a cup of coffee. He's a middle-aged man wearing a bow tie and a satin hatband. Taking some folded pages from his pocket, he sits beside Georgia.
I think you understand.
You mean you're through with me? This is the end.
To put it bluntly?
It means that little to you?
Look, my dear, we are two civilized people. Let us act like civilized people.
They told me about you. I didn't believe them. You hear you...
You're everything.
Oh, yeah. But you're everything you said. You hear evil. You see evil. You speak evil. You are evil.
She mimes throwing a drink in his face. Later, in a projection room, Georgia and Gus watch her filmed test.
Put it bluntly.
She glances at the projectionist, who beckons her to a viewing window. Looking out at the film screen, Georgia sees herself costumed in an elegant gown.
They told me about you. I didn't believe them. But you're everything they said. You hear evil. You see evil. You speak evil. You are evil.
She splashes an actor with her drink. Then the film ends. The projectionist opens the window, and Georgia listens in to the screening room.
What do you think? Well, Wick?
My dear Jonathan, since you pay me $100,000 to direct this picture, quite a lot of pounds sterling, presumably you want my kind of picture. With this girl, I tell you flatly, it will not be my kind of picture. She's impossible.
Quite.
She's wooden, gauche, artificial. Completely out of the question.
Quite.
Jonathan pulls off his loafers and rubs his feet.
Sid?
Jonathan, since you hire me partly to yes you...
You're fired.
She stinks.
You're hired. Harry?
I know we can get her for nothing. For nothing, you get nothing. She's nothing.
Gus takes her aside.
There were few agents in town with fewer clients than Gus... But the few he had, he knew well.
By a water cooler, he pours Georgia a drink from a flask. Later, they wait inside Jonathan's office, seated in deep leather chairs. One of the wide double doors opens, and Jonathan marches in, glaring as Gus stands with his hat in his hand.
Well, I told you not to waste your film.
Gus, check with Harry Pebble. He's drawing up the contracts.
She's in?
Of course.
You mean you're going to give her a part?
The part.
Georgia.
She hands Gus a handkerchief.
Georgia.
Mr. Shields, you're a very stubborn man.
Very, when I'm right. And I know I'm right about you. I gave you no help. The test was atrocious. But bad as it was, it proved one thing. When you're on the screen, no matter who you're with, what you're doing, the audience is looking at you. That star quality. Lorison quality.
Careful, Mr. Shields. You're looking at me, but you see my father. He gave me his name, but that's all he gave me. Don't make a mistake.
Georgia. No more doom, daughter. No more whimpering. No more drinking.
And no more men?
Fine, but... Gus, pull yourself together.
Can't help it, Mr. Shields. I'm a very emotional man.
Squeezing his hat, Gus turns away and bawls into the handkerchief.
The picture was to start in 6 weeks. And 6 weeks seemed like forever. Then, suddenly with fittings and hairdressing and makeup tests, 5 of them were gone.
Now, Georgia models a gown.
I don't know what to do. The waist has to be that tight, and the train has to be that long. There isn't any
Evelyn,
line
will
to
you
it.
Tell me what it is that's worrying you?
Would you walk over there, please?
A seamstress straightens the gown's train. Then Georgia takes a few wobbly strides across Jonathan's office.
Now turn.
The train winds around Georgia's legs.
Mr. Shields, I'm afraid Miss Larson can't carry a dress like this. It takes an enormous amount of poise. For this type of thing, you have to walk with the assurance of a grand duchess or hold yourself like Lily Langtry, but...
Miss Larson will hold herself like Miss Larson. Miss Larson happens to be an actress. Make a wider turn, Georgia.
Georgia smooths her hair, then straightens her broad back.
Now come over here.
As she totters toward Jonathan, he grips her shoulders and guides her to a chair.
Right. Come here, dear. Now sit down. Can you sit down?
No.
That's perfect. All right, now everybody out now, please. I want to talk to my star.
The costume designer and her assistants leave. Georgia smiles wearily at Jonathan.
Well, 1 week to go. Nervous?
A little.
Tired?
Oh, fair.
You worked very hard. Been a good girl.
How good?
He touches her cheek.
Sending you away to Palm Springs for the rest of the week.
Must I?
Absolutely. You get on that set a week from Wednesday. I want you to sleep, relax, not think about a thing.
Not even you.
Jonathan opens a split of champagne.
You said no drinking.
One drink.
He pours the champagne into two glasses and hands one to Georgia. Her soft smile wavers as he steps close to her.
To Georgia, my star.
He kisses her.
You said no men.
So I did.
A director bursts in with Harry Pebble.
Dear Jonathan, I thought we'd agreed.
You agreed all by yourself.
And dear man, no put words in my mouth. I don't know who...
Georgia blows Jonathan a kiss as she leaves.
Out. My pavilion for the garden party. It was understood it was to be 3 feet off the ground. It was discussed, suggested, and determined.
Look, to build that 3 feet will cost, with operation charges and additional shooting time, at least $25,000, more or less, and with you, more.
I cannot shoot without it. I will not shoot without it. I'm billing an entire sequence to that one moment. I must have the height.
So move your camera up.
I will not cheat the shot. That's not the way I function.
My dear man, I'm not asking
barges
you
in.
You function. I'm not
asking
you
to cheat the shot. Get out of here. Get out of here. I got something to show you.
I want to show you. That puts up money for
this. This is wonderful.
Removing his overcoat, he leads Jonathan to the office window.
Look.
My new car. I don't
care. He points to a two-toned roadster with a brunette starlet seated inside. Gaucho dangles the car keys in front of Jonathan.
How would you like to drive it around the block?
I'm busy.
A smoother drive you will never have.
Gaucho, I'm busy.
How long would a quick ride take over?
Gaucho, I am busy.
Ah, you're always busy. Why don't you live a little, hombre? Adios, adios.
Gaucho leaves with his coat tucked under his arm. Jonathan props one leg on a chair and watches Harry argue with the director, Whitfield.
And I'm the one who's got to go on and...
But I can't be shooting up their noses.
Nobody's asking you to shoot up their noses or up any...
Gentlemen, there seems to be an honest difference of opinion.
There is.
It looks as though we'll have to make a compromise.
You bet we will.
The compromise, gentlemen, is this. Harry, shut your penny-pinching mouth and build him his platform.
Whitfield defiantly puts his hands on his hips and glares at Harry. Later, Georgia wanders onto a closed soundstage. Ceiling-mounted lamps throw wide circles of light onto the bare floor. Coils of cable hang on equipment booms throughout the warehouse-sized building. Georgia approaches a carpeted staircase, which curves upward on the set of an ornate mansion.
The night before we started shooting, I came back from Palm Springs. I tried to sleep. I couldn't. I don't know what drew me to the empty stage. I guess I was scared.
She turns aside before reaching the set. Among a cluster of director's chairs, Georgia finds one with her name printed on its canvas back. Nearby stands her dressing room, a portable trailer with her name on the door, and soft upholstered furniture inside. Georgia finds a wrapped gift on her makeup table and tugs off its satin ribbon. She opens a velvet jewel box, takes out a strand of pearls, then reads an enclosed note.
To my new star, who will make me very proud of her, Jonathan.
Georgia catches her stolid reflection in the mirror. She walks out of the trailer.
It was cold on the set. And suddenly my throat was dry. So dry, I knew I had to have a drink.
Her steps quicken as she leaves the soundstage, swinging the pearls in her hand. The next day, Whitfield and his assistant sit in front of Georgia's empty chair. Harry, Jonathan, and Sid wait in her dressing room.
Papers know all about it. I asked the boys to lay off.
But with this one, she'll burn up every column in the country.
I want her to make a picture with her. Make a star to someone this town tossed on the ash heap.
Frost her off, Jonathan. Let me contact the agents and see who's available.
Jonathan looks at his hands.
All right, Harry. Cast it and get it over with. I'll tell Whitfield to shoot around the park.
Later, at home, Jonathan puts on a cummerbund. Sid walks in.
Sorry I'm late.
Get out a release. We're signing Ann Gailey for the part tomorrow morning.
Glaring at the mirror, Jonathan brushes his wavy blonde hair.
Every time I go to the morgue, I get the heebie-jeebies.
Forget her.
I covered everything. Waterfront, jails, hospitals, strip to the Main Street booze parlor.
I told you to forget her.
Yeah, my professional pride. I thought I knew every rat hole in town. Either she's found a new one, or she's far, far away. Janitor says when she goes off on a bat, she locks the door and leaves for days at a time.
Jonathan's eyes widen. Grabbing his dinner jacket, he bolts from the room. Later, he arrives at George's apartment door. The knob holds firm. He shoulders the door, then kicks. The door flies open. Inside, Georgia slouches in the easy chair, surrounded by piles of laundry and empty bottles.
Hello, Georgia.
Still wearing his dinner jacket, Jonathan looks down at her.
You forgot. You forgot to tie your tie.
Georgia struggles to her feet, still holding the strand of pearls. The tail of her white blouse hangs out of her suit skirt. She staggers toward Jonathan, then passes out in his arms. Jonathan grabs her coat, wraps her in it, and lifts her limp frame. He carries her from the apartment. Later, Jonathan steps off a manicured grass path onto a tiled patio. Cradled in his arms, Georgia lies unconscious. He gazes tenderly at her angelic face, then lifts his eyes to the sky. With a gentle push, he drops her into a swimming pool.
Mike! Oh!
Later, Georgia returns to the patio with her hair wrapped in a towel and a wool overcoat buttoned around her. Glancing sheepishly at Jonathan, she sits down at his feet.
You're sorry, aren't you?
What do you want me to do? Wash out your mouth with soap and send you to bed without your supper?
She nods meekly.
Why'd you do it, Georgia? Do you know why?
She shakes her head no, then changes it to a nod.
Why?
Because I was afraid I'd blouse things up for you. Because I love you. I do, you know.
She closes her collar around her throat.
It's cold sitting on the ground.
Georgia, come here.
He pats the sofa cushion next to him.
Sit down.
Georgia shuffles over to him. As she starts to sit, he pulls her onto his lap. Her eyes widen, then she notices the pearls in his hand. She softens as he fastens them around her neck, then wraps her in his arms.
Georgia, love is for the very young.
For the very young. I like that. Would you marry me, Jonathan?
Not even a little bit.
That's too bad.
Why?
Because I'd make you a good wife.
Well, right now, I don't need a wife. I need a star.
George's forehead puckers.
It's cold, not sitting on the ground.
All right, let's go by the fire, shall we?
Georgia pads barefooted into a sitting room where logs blaze in a fireplace. Her wet clothes hang on a chair in front of the hearth.
We're signing Anne Gavry for the part.
Oh? She'll be good.
I think she will.
Why, that big ham, she couldn't... Well, she...
Here.
You know, Jonathan, if we were married, I wouldn't take up much room.
Oh, Georgia. I go on and put those things on. Your clothes will be dry in a minute.
She takes a bundle of clean clothes through a sliding door to a changing room. By the fireplace, Jonathan picks up a wet blouse and hangs it on the chair with George's clothes. Glancing over his shoulder, he hurries across the room to a bar and closes a wall-sized liquor cabinet filled with bottles. He starts to lock it, then pauses. Shrugging, he puts away the key and reopens the cabinet doors.
Hello.
Jonathan, where have you been? I've been trying to reach you.
Oh, Harry.
You Harry.
In the changing room, Georgia fingers an extension phone. As she gently lifts the receiver, Jonathan freezes and stares at the sliding door. Smirking, he leans on the bar.
Harry. Harry, forget about Anne Gavry.
Jonathan, have you gone crazy? Are you drunk?
I said forget about her. George is right here.
Georgia?
Everything's fine. We're going to use her.
Oh, now listen to me. I don't know what you've got in your mind, but I'm not going to let you make a fool of her.
I'll take that chance, Harry.
Again.
We'll see about... I know. Harry, listen to me. Harry, shut up and listen to me. These are my instructions. George is in. We'll shoot her first scene in the morning.
You call Whitfield and tell him.
In the changing room, Georgia hangs up.
Harry. Harry, shut up and listen to me. Don't worry. Everything's going to be all right. I know just how to handle her now.
Georgia peeks in through the sliding door. Now dressed in oversized men's pajamas, she wears the pearls at her throat and a towel wrapped on her head like a turban.
They're blue.
Trembling, she puts on a terry cloth robe. Jonathan helps her.
Blue is my lucky.
Jonathan spins her around and kisses her hard on the mouth. Georgia tilts her head and closes her eyes.
Color.
Standing on tiptoe, she throws her arms around his neck and returns his kiss. Another day, over sandwiches and milk, Jonathan reads lines with Georgia.
We were 14 weeks shooting the picture. The most wonderful 14 weeks I'd ever known.
Georgia makes notes of Jonathan's instructions.
See him. Up.
Later on the set, Jonathan coaches her through a scene in a theater box. Georgia teasingly peers at him through opera glasses.
You suddenly see him and you know somebody's going to kill him. Now, Mia, you take it. Man, if you're going to joke about it.
She kisses him and he sulks.
No, wait, I'll try.
No, you don't want to take the thing seriously.
No, once more.
I'll try once more, that's all.
In a restaurant, Georgia lights a cigarette.
That's great. What's all this mumble jumble, doesn't it? And he stands slow. Try it again. And make love while you're lighting the cigarette. Make it mean something. Go ahead, take it.
Georgia lifts another cigarette to her pouting lips. Cupping it in her hands, she lights it, then blows a stream of smoke over Jonathan's head. Now, Georgia and Gaucho act out an orthodox wedding scene.
Jonathan was a perfectionist. When he was in love with a scene, money meant nothing to him. Fatigue even less, his or anyone else's. We did it over and over and over till we could hardly stand.
In the scene, Gaucho wears a white military uniform and Georgia an ornate wedding gown. A priest makes the sign of the cross with a crown, then Georgia kisses it. Jonathan stands off set.
All right, cut. How was that?
Try it again.
Jonathan! For heaven's sake! Fun is fun.
Jonathan, you've got...
Did they get it?
I don't know. There are still arguing up there.
An extra pulls off her peasant's kerchief.
This is amateur night in Dixie. Well, they better make up their minds sooner. They're going to lose baby.
Hiya, baby.
Gaucho.
You were going to get me into pictures.
It takes a little while, baby. I worked extra for 3 years. This is good experience.
This is experience?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the time they get me a speaking part, they're going to have to carry me off and on the set.
You look awful pretty when you're a man.
Thanks a lot.
All right, folks, wrap it up. Atmosphere people outside. The hot set, close it off. Same setup first thing in the morning.
Georgia walks off the set with Jonathan.
Good night, Miss Larson.
Good night, George.
Rush isn't saying
good night, John.
Yes,
good night,
Miss Larson. Thanks.
Good night, Lola. I thought that take was good.
It was pretty good, but I want to get a little more out of Gaucho.
Gaucho's girlfriend, Lila, rolls her eyes.
Happy?
Very. Are you, Jonathan?
Very. May I buy you dinner tonight?
And tomorrow night.
That's the look I want in that wedding scene. Can you give me that?
I'll try.
He lifts George's hands to his lips and kisses them. She stares after him adoringly as he leaves.
Mr. Shields, we were 5 over budget today. I'll have to have your signature on these sheets before I can...
Gaucho strides over to Lila.
Hi, Jimmy. Hurry up, baby. Hurry up.
Be an angel. Bring my car around, will you?
Si, senor. Si, senor. You want me to wash it for you, too?
Oh, Georgia. You were wonderful in that scene. Very lovely.
Thank you.
Every day I watch you grow more and more an actress.
Georgia continues watching Jonathan, who shows her 8 fingers, then waves goodbye.
To give truth to a performance, there's nothing like love.
Love is for the very young. Love is for the birds.
Gaucho and Georgia glare at Lila, then look back at each other.
Good night, Georgia.
Good night, Gaucho.
Gaucho marches over to Lila and grabs her sternly by the shoulders.
Lila, that wasn't nice.
She wrenches free.
I guess it all depends on who a girl has dinner with around here, doesn't it?
Shh, baby.
She gets to be a star. I get to park a convertible.
Georgia stops and listens.
Or Jonathan. He's a great man.
There are no great men, Buster. There's only men. The last 2 weeks of the picture, I was in a dream. A bad dream.
On the set, a crewman sprays smoke at the foot of a staircase. Peasants rush down the stairs as Cossacks storm through a door. Costumed in a kerchief, Georgia pushes through the crowd. Later, in her dressing room, she slumps over her makeup table while her maid rubs her shoulders.
They're ready, Miss Laurison.
She'll be right there. I don't know what to do. I feel sick and frightened.
You're tired, honey. You've been trying so hard.
Yeah, but they think I'm such a fool or temperamental or something.
It's all right. There's only a few more days.
Yeah, but I keep feeling like I'm going to scream and I can't help myself.
Hurry, Miss Larson, please. They're all waiting.
Later, they shoot a death scene.
We were on the last scene. We finished a little before dawn. We're alone now. And I can talk to you. Now I can tell you what I never could tell you before. And you must forgive me, my darling. You must...
In character, Georgia strokes Gaucho's face. Just off set, the crew watches the scene intently. Lighting and sound technicians lean on their stepladders, their foreheads creased with concentration. On a catwalk above them, a spotlight operator looks on with a mesmerized smile. Later, at a Hollywood premiere, another spotlight sweeps over a grandstand filled with fans. As Sid Murphy helps Georgia out of a limo, young women rush the carpeted walkway holding out their autograph books. Georgia beams as she passes them, dressed in a sparkling white gown and ermine stole. After the show, Georgia enters a ballroom with Gaucho. Harry Pebble and other party guests toast them with their champagne glasses.
After the opening, there was a party. It was a lovely, happy, top-of-the-world party. It was my party, and everybody was there. And everybody made a fuss over it. Everybody but Jonathan.
The studio men hover around Georgia's table, all talking at once. She pretends to listen while anxiously searching the room with her eyes. Later, at Jonathan's mansion, she runs to the front door with a magnum of champagne. Her face hardens as she presses the buzzer with the heel of her hand. Stepping back, Georgia looks up at the home's ivy-covered brick walls. A light comes on in a window, and she rushes back to the doorbell. Georgia cradles the long glass bottle on her arm and presses the bell hard. Inside, Jonathan pauses on the stairs, a cigarette smoldering between his fingers. Straightening his shoulders, he strides toward the front door and opens it.
Well, you wouldn't come to my party, so I brought my party to you. Jonathan, it was so wonderful. Everything you wanted for me, just as you promised. They applauded and cheered and they owed and awed.
Georgia, go back and enjoy it.
But there's no one to enjoy it with.
Why, that's silly. Everybody in town is fighting with each other to be near the new star.
You know what I mean, Jonathan.
Georgia, I have to be alone tonight. After a picture's finished, something happens to me. It's a feeling of letdown, of emptiness. It's bad. It gets worse. I can't help it.
I know. Sid and Harry have told me about that. Oh, but tonight...
I've only depressed you. I want you to go back now. You've got vows to take. Take them.
Darling, I was afraid you might be angry or resent my coming here, but I had to take that chance. Why, right in the middle of everything, suddenly I knew one thing so clearly. The party is where you are. Depressed or gay or angry or... tender, or in any of your moods. I know them all.
Georgia.
Oh, let's have our party, darling. We've got so much to celebrate. We'll ice the champagne, and we'll light the fire, and we'll put on the records and dance, and I'll help you pull yourself out of this the way you helped me. Oh, give me that chance, darling. Please. Please, don't shut me out. Please.
As she embraces him, a shadow appears on the stairs. It's Lila, wearing a strapless velvet gown, her hair hanging loosely at her shoulders. She rests her slender arm on the banister.
Thought you said you were going to get rid of her quick.
Now you go back to your party.
The picture's finished, Georgia. Your business. I'm company.
Shut up. Shut up and get back upstairs.
Lila leans forward, exposing a hint of her cleavage. She slinks up the stairs.
Oh, I forgot to tell you, Georgia. I saw the picture. Thought you were swell.
At the bottom of the stairs, Jonathan clings to the banister.
Good night, Georgia.
Georgia stands frozen, wrapped in her white furs. He turns toward her, his teeth clenched.
Stop looking like that. Remember, I didn't ask you here. You couldn't stay where you belong, could you? You couldn't enjoy what I made possible for you, no. You'd rather have this. Well, congratulations. You've got it. All laid out for you so you can wallow in pity for yourself. The betrayed woman. The wounded doe with all the dribble that goes with it going through your mind right now. Oh, he doesn't love me at all. He was lying. All those lovely moments, those tender words. He's lying. He's cheap and cruel. That low woman, Lila. Well, maybe I like Lilas. Maybe I like to be cheap once in a while. Maybe everybody does. Or don't you remember?
She backs away, and he grabs her.
Get that look off your face.
Who gave you the right to dig into me and turn me inside out and decide what I'm like? How do you know how I feel about you, how deep it goes?
Maybe I don't want anybody to own me, you or anybody.
Get out! Get out! Get out!
Georgia staggers outside. Holding her arms out for balance, she teeters to her car and speeds away. Behind the wheel, Georgia rocks with choking sobs. Her tears shine in the headlights of oncoming traffic. As her car hurtles along the highway, raindrops spatter the windshield. The rain becomes a downpour, which slants past her windows. The car bounces over the road as it gains speed. Georgia shakes her head violently, then falls back against her seat and shuts her eyes. Stomping the brake pedal, Georgia lets go of the wheel. She braces herself with both hands. The car pitches from side to side. It rolls forward out of control, slows, then stops. Unhurt, Georgia slumps over the steering wheel. Now, back in Harry Pebble's office.
I told you I'd never work for him again, and I never will.
I don't blame you, Georgia. Jonathan certainly ruined you. You were a drunk and a tramp, playing bit parts around town, and he made a star out of you. You had an ironclad contract with Shields Productions. Iron, I know, because I drew it myself. Starting at $100 a week, we owned you body and soul. And the next morning, you walked right into this office and you stood right here. But that same look you've got on your face now. And you threw the bits of your contract into my face. Jonathan laughed and let you get away with it. I want to take you to court. But he said no. So you signed with A&L and made them the millions that we should have made. For the last 7 years, you've been in the top 10 in every popularity poll in this country.
Ah, yes. Jonathan sure fouled you up.
Jim, you're pretty happy with yourself these days, aren't you? You and your Pulitzer. To James Lee Bartlow, whose first book, so-and-so, graduate of Harvard and the Sorbonne, the year 1949 found him professor of medieval history at one of our leading southern universities.
Now, Jim, wearing a T-shirt and a windbreaker, steps onto a town sidewalk.
Summer is the quietest time of the year in a college town, and the loveliest. I was outlining what I hoped would be my second novel. My first, on which I'd labored 7 years, was just out. Surprisingly, for a scholarly work about early Virginia, my book was enjoying a brisk nationwide sale, possibly because it was liberally peppered with sex. Because, after all, early Virginia was liberally peppered with sex. Could that have been why Hollywood had bought it?
Jim makes a note inside a matchbook.
Why did I stay away from home that afternoon? Because Rosemary, my wife, was entertaining the symposium, a group of faculty wives who met bi-monthly to enjoy a little culture and a lot of gossip. Rosemary had the floor. She was reading an anthropological paper on the island of St. Daniel's, which we visited the summer before.
Habits, the techniques of courtship, marriage, and consummation.
At home, in the front parlor, women wearing hats drink tea while Jim's wife reads an essay.
They are certainly not for the drawing room. The Longhorns.
Jim listens in for a moment, then crosses the hall to his study and shuts the door.
Her paper seemed to be getting a good reception, possibly because it was liberally peppered with sex. Because, after all, the island of St. Daniel's is liberally peppered with sex.
Settling into a rocking chair, Jim empties matchbooks from his pockets and tosses them into a candy dish with others. He crouches over a typewriter on a low table.
I started to work.
James Lee doesn't mind one bit, do you, darling? He never minds.
A woman brings a book.
Autograph, Miss Rosser?
Now, Mr. Rosser, isn't this just like a man? I just fixed his study with everything a successful author could want. And there he will sit in that dreary old rocker, clickety-clack on that dilapidated old potable.
I suppose we'll be losing you to Hollywood now, Professor Bartlow.
The James Lee Bartlows in Hollywood. Isn't that a ridiculous idea? Besides which, what could Hollywood possibly offer us?
Besides which, Hollywood hasn't asked us.
What'd he write?
Mrs. Rosser opens his book titled The Proud Land. She blanches.
Oh, Professor, you shouldn't have.
James Lee, you have a very naughty mind. I'm happy to say.
Jim pulls his wife James down Lee, into no, his lap.
Not there. I can't. No, James Lee.
Holding her, he plants a firm kiss on her mouth. Rosemary smiles and tenderly pecks his nose. Running her fingers through Jim's short, dark hair, she holds him in a long, passionate kiss. Rosemary is a petite blonde with narrow, smiling eyes and dimpled cheeks. She gets up from Jim's lap, smooths the skirt of her high-collared dress, and walks to the door, holding a pair of eyeglasses in one hand.
I started to work.
A maid carries in a tray of food.
Mrs. Bartlow says eat. It'll do you good.
Thanks, Millie. I started to work. Hello? Yes, this is Professor Bartlow. Who? Where? Oh, yes, put him on.
Jim rests his elbows on his knees and twiddles a golf tee.
Hello, Mr. Shields. Fine, thanks.
Rosemary bursts in.
Hollywood, Jonathan Shields.
She pulls up a chair beside him.
Sure, I'm glad you bought the book. I hope your movie of it makes me as happy as your check did.
He rocks back, and Rosemary sits back, too.
No, I'm sorry. I don't see how I can.
She covers the receiver.
Working on your new novel. Now, go on, tell
him. I need all summer to work on my new book.
Turning the phone, she listens in.
No, don't tell him what it's about.
Well, get your hand away. I'd rather not discuss it until it's finished.
Rosemary grins.
My, just listen to that man talk. All expenses paid. You just tell him you'll think it over.
No, it's impossible. I can't come out now.
Rosemary presses her ear closer to the phone.
Say something charming for goodbye.
Goodbye, Mr. Shields.
James Lee, that was not charming.
He has enough charm for all three of us.
Pouting, Rosemary slumps.
He surely rubbed you the wrong way.
He surely did.
I don't want you ever to feel sorry. You didn't say yes to Mr. Shields. What if we do spend the whole hot summer here? It doesn't matter. Because someday, I just know we'll get to travel and see all those wonderful places. So don't you ever feel one bit sorry. You didn't say yes, James Lee.
She smiles sweetly at him and squeezes his arm. Jim puts down his pipe.
Does a trip to Hollywood mean that much to you, Rosemary?
Me?
Later, under a cloudless sky, a car arrives at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
After all, it was only for 2 weeks, all expenses paid. It wasn't as though Mr. Shields wanted me to write a screenplay for him. All he wanted was to talk, to get my ideas on his ideas.
Sid Murphy takes them to a bungalow.
Is this everything?
Yeah, that's all of it.
Good. Hey, how about it, Mrs. Bartlow? Is this bungalow all right with you?
Oh, it's completely enchanting.
Good. Oh, the studio car's yours as long as you're here.
Thank you.
I've got to run along now. I have to meet a fellow from the syndicate. He's a nice guy, but he hated our last two pictures. He has sinus. Bye.
When do I see the great man?
Jonathan? Oh, drop around the studio tomorrow morning. Not too early, not too late. Bye, Miss Bartlow.
Rosemary gazes through a sliding glass door at a patio decorated with tropical palms.
James Lee, come here. Hurry up. Hurry up.
On the neighboring terrace, Georgia leafs through a magazine.
It's Georgia Lawrenson. Living in the very next bungalow.
Well, what do you know?
That night, Rosemary wrote 32 postcards. Next morning, I mailed them and we went to the studio.
On a set crowded with furniture and props, Jonathan shows the Bartlows a formal dining set.
Oh! Why, look here, James Lee. The dining room at Roanoke. Just the way we saw it when you wrote it.
Just the way I saw it when I read it.
Look at that chandelier. Why, it's Walford, isn't it?
Yes, Mrs. Bartlow, it is.
You know, you write in motion picture terms. Do you like movies?
The good ones.
How would you like to stay on and write the script?
No.
Why not?
You look much younger than I thought you would.
Hmm?
Must take pretty good care of yourself.
I do.
Well, so do I. I'm here for 2 weeks only. Get your money's worth out of that.
James Lee, there's never been such silver. Not even in Richmond. I wouldn't have missed this for anything. You know, Mr. Shields, James Lee didn't think it proper for me to come along this morning.
The professor's a man of rigid ideas. However, we're delighted to have you with us, Mrs. Bartlett.
Oh, see, darling. I knew it was just plain sociable for me to come and say hello. And don't you worry, Mr. Shields. I won't be a nuisance. When James Lee is busy with you, well, I'll be busy with my own work.
What kind of work is that, Mrs. Bartlow?
Well, it's nothing really, but I did promise the symposium I'd do a paper for them on Hollywood. Of course, I realize that in 2 weeks, I can't do more than just barely scratch the surface.
In the bright sunlight, Jim waits for Rosemary to catch up with him and take his arm. Sid walks them to their car with Jonathan, who sports a thin mustache.
Professor, take time to get the feel of things, then we'll get together, huh?
Shall I phone you?
No, let me phone you.
Rosemary gets in the car, then pokes her head out the window.
Thank you, Mr. Shields. It was wonderful fun. I like being a successful author's wife. It took me a long time to learn the secret. His work comes first.
Visit us again, won't
you? Thank you, goodbye.
His work comes first.
Yeah, she's the kind that buys dark glasses with his first salary check.
No wonder it took him 7 years to write a book.
Do you have to happen to write your script?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you can keep him in Hollywood?
Mm-hmm.
He kept me all right. 2 weeks later, I found I'd signed with Shields Productions to write a treatment of the Proud Land.
So you like my ideas?
Yes.
All of them?
No.
A photo of Hugo Shields.
Who is that? You have his picture all over the studio.
That's my father.
Angry little man, wasn't he? I may as well warn you, I don't know how I'll work in an office. I'm used to an old portable and a soft rocker.
Superstitious mind?
No. Supersensitive rare.
He stops at another picture of Hugo. Walking ahead, Jonathan smirks, then ceremoniously pushes open an office door. Jim spots his low table, black typewriter, rocking chair, and windbreaker.
I had them flown out. I thought it'd make you happy. I gather I failed.
Well, you were pretty sure of yourself. Pretty sure I'd stay.
Yes, I was.
I know the legend. Jonathan Shields. The man who'll do anything to get what he wants. Ah, oh, thanks.
A box of matchbooks.
Shields Pictures Incorporated. Well, I'm flattered you want me and bitter you've got me. Where do I start?
Just read these scripts, see how it's done. Rough out a storyline, and then we'll get to work. And don't worry. Some of the best movies are made by people working together who hate each other's guts.
Then we should make a great movie.
I usually do.
What about your last two?
I like them.
Jonathan leaves the writer smoking his pipe. Later, wearing his windbreaker, Jim rocks and smokes.
I started to work.
Outside, Rosemary has a mink jacket.
Look!
Posing in front of a shiny convertible, she models the fur.
How do you like it?
I'll be right down.
Jim raises his eyebrows and sucks on his pipe. Another day, Jim writes in the bungalow.
I started to work.
What is it, Rosemary?
But, dear, I told you I can't. I know it's Sunday, but I've only written a half a page all week.
He glances around at his tabletop.
All right, Rosemary. Where is it?
He opens desk drawers, yes. Then scrolls up the paper in his typewriter.
Not so fast.
Later, the Bartlows come home from a party. The stern-faced Rosemary wears a black taffeta dress and evening gloves. As they enter their bedroom, Jim unbuttons the bow tie of his tuxedo. His wife marches across the room, then spins around with a haughty glare.
Walking out that way? Well, you were rude. I don't care how you feel about Jonathan Shields. If you are a gentleman, there is no justification for boorishness.
Yes, Jim takes out handfuls of matchbooks and glances inside the cover of each one.
Incidentally, who was that overgrown bullfighter you danced with all night?
You mean Victor Rivera? Gaucho? Well, I only danced with him twice.
An hour each time.
My, you do get nasty when you're jealous. Like the time you carried on in St. Daniel's over that charming young governor's aide.
He was too charming.
Why, he meant nothing, nothing at all. You were even jealous of that Swiss exchange professor just because he was polite.
He was too polite. Now, Rosemary, let's get some sleep.
Oh, James Lee Bartlow, you take a good look at yourself in that mirror. You've changed since you come to Hollywood, and I don't mind telling you it's no change for the better.
He glares hotly at her, then drops his shoulders and looks at the dresser. Behind him, Rosemary bows her head.
Have I changed, too? I dare say I am getting a little too big for my breeches.
Jim chuckles. Turning, he puts his arms around his wife's waist, and she smiles.
They're pretty breeches.
James Lee, you have a very naughty mind. I'm happy to say.
Jim leans in to kiss her. She teasingly pulls away. With a seductive sway of her hips, she returns to his embrace, then parts her lips for a slow kiss. Another day in Jim's office, Jonathan pulls a blank sheet of paper from the typewriter, then rummages through several more empty pages. He stalks over to Jim, asleep on the sofa. Jonathan's fingers twitch anxiously. Finding a wallet-sized notebook on the table, he riffles through it. Every lined page is blank. His thumb flips to the beginning, where he finds some pencil-drawn doodles. Glaring at the sleeping writer, Jonathan drops the notebook. He walks out coolly, then storms into the main office, where a secretary works at her desk.
Get me, Gaucho.
Jonathan barges through a short swinging gate, then opens Harry's door.
Harry.
He looks back at the secretary.
Call Arrowhead.
Long distance, please. Left Arrowhead, California.
Harry Pebble strolls into the adjacent office and sits down as Jonathan takes off his shoes.
Oh, Harry, I'm going up the lake with James Lee, just the two of us. We're going to get this treatment written.
When are you leaving?
In an hour.
The bank called. They want to talk to you.
Oh, tell them I said you could talk to them.
They're getting tough.
Getting too old.
You got something there.
Hello, Gaucho? Oh, just a minute. Harry, you take care of it, will you? You can handle it.
All right.
Harry leaves, and Jonathan props his stockinged foot on his desk.
Gaucho? Kita. Muy bien. Hey, how you booked for social life? Well, get yourself unbooked. How'd you like to squire a genuine Virginia dame? I said squire.
He rubs his toes.
Huh? Mrs. James Lee Bartle. Yeah, Mister is going up the lake with me. Keep her occupied. Will you, Gaucho, so she doesn't get in our hair? Yeah.
Later, an alarm clock reads 6:30. Jim sits up in a twin bed and stares wall-eyed.
I started to work.
Meanwhile, Jonathan goes fishing.
I worked all day from 7 till noon, from 2 till 5. There were no interruptions.
Later, in the cabin, Jonathan edits pages.
In the evenings, we work together.
He crosses out line after line. Jim snatches the pages from him.
Jonathan, that's my best scene.
cut it down to 3 lines.
Look, Jonathan, I don't think you understand. The boy's going away, probably to be killed. So when the mother speaks...
She doesn't speak. We move the camera in close on her. She opens her mouth to talk, but she can't. She's too emotional to be able to speak. And what she's feeling, we'll leave for the audience to imagine. Believe me, Jim, they'll imagine it better than any words you and I could ever write. All right with you?
Yes, Professor.
Now for that last scene.
Later, as Jonathan drives them home, Jim smokes his pipe and stares ahead wearily.
Proud of yourself?
A little. Should be.
Not a weak scene in the whole treatment.
I'm proud of Rosemary, too. She didn't interrupt once the whole time we were up there.
Pleasant, wasn't it?
I tell you the truth, I missed her interruptions. Even when she's a bother, she does it in a gay, naive, Southern belle kind of a way that tickles me.
Say, Jim, how come you never tried to get her down on paper as one of the women in your book?
I did try.
Just wouldn't write, eh?
No. Funny.
Maybe you just don't know her well enough.
Jonathan pulls into a service station where an attendant with a bow tie and a paper cap greets them. Jim gets out and strolls around the car while Jonathan pops open the hood. He twists off the radiator cap. White steam spurts into the air. Jonathan claps dirt from his hands.
Come back, you better check the radiator too, will you?
Okay.
Jim walks over to an ice chest and gets himself a bottle of soda. He takes a sip, then glances at a newspaper stand. The headline, "Gaucho in Plane Crash," appears above a picture of Rosemary. Jim grabs the paper and reads, "Film star and writer's wife feared dead." Later at the crash site, Sid Murphy meets Jim's helicopter.
What's the story? Is Gaucho a friend of his?
That's right.
What's she going to marry, Gaucho?
Where are they going to Mexico to get a divorce?
How about it? Were they flying for a Mexican divorce?
I just told you that's ridiculous.
How long was she in love with him?
When was the last time he saw her?
Now, this is it, boys. Gaucho was a close friend of the Bartlows. He was flying into the lake to join the professor.
His flight plan said Acapulco.
What flight plan?
Sid, what's the matter, Murphy? Don't you want to play ball with the press?
I just told you Gaucho was a close friend of the Bartlows. He was flying into the lake to join the
professor. All right, let Mr. Bartle through to identify the body. Come on.
A sheriff leads Jim past the plane's broken fuselage to a sandy ridge. An officer with a flashlight leads the way up a 10-foot-tall ladder. The sheriff climbs up next, then Jim, taking slow, deliberate steps up the ladder rungs. Atop the ridge, the sheriff lifts a blanket from a body. Jim nods. Back at home, Jonathan brings a drink to Jim, who sits by the fireplace holding his pipe.
I wish an awful lot. Maybe if I'd been here. You didn't know about them, did you? Sorry, Jonathan. Of course you didn't know.
Look, Jim. I'm not going to let you brood about her. She's dead and you're alive.
He puts his arm around Jim's shoulder.
You can't do anything about it. Neither can I. Let's get to work, you and I.
Jim taps his pipe stem against his glass. Later, Jonathan fills Jim's pipe while he works.
Without Jonathan, I don't know what I'd have done those next few months. He put me to work and kept me working. And when the shooting script of The Proud Land was finished, he asked me to stay with him for production meetings and casting.
If you see Miss Runley as a star of The Proud Land, then that is what you see.
Von Elstein.
This was a woman of sex. To me, Miss Runley has the sex appeal of an angleworm.
How about that, Jonathan? How about what? Oh,
I like Linda Runley.
I wonder,
Yes, Jim?
Oh, I know it's not my department.
No, go ahead. You're among friends.
All the time we were writing the script, I had one girl in mind. She lives right next to my bungalow. I think she'd be fine.
Who?
Georgia Lorison.
They all freeze.
You'd like me to give her the script?
Professor, you have just broken a sacred taboo. You have mentioned the unmentionable.
That's enough. That's all right, Sid. Georgia is the best. The best actress, the best box office. Her last three pictures for Fred Amell grossed, Harry?
$7,600,000 domestic.
tried to get her, we'd be wasting our time. She hates my guts.
Jonathan storms out of his own office. A moment later, he comes back in.
Jim, if you want to show her the script, there's no way I can stop you.
Later, in George's trailer.
What am I supposed to do? Thank you for saying no?
Well, what are you trying to do? Fight Jonathan Shields' battles for him?
It happens to be my book.
It happens to be his picture. You're the first person I ever knew who began by hating him and ended up liking him. Do you always do everything backwards?
Do you still love him?
Fred Amiel.
Oh, excuse me.
Fred, do I still love Jonathan?
Oh, no. You don't get me on that one.
That was a stupid question for a writer. Don't you know about first love? You may grow out of it, but you don't get over it. Oh, I'm sorry. That was stupid of me.
No, no. I wouldn't want to get over my first love either. Quite.
Well, it's time you two met, Fred Amiel, James Bartlow.
How are you, Bartlow?
Guess who we were fighting about?
Jonathan is more than a man. He's an experience, and he's habit forming. If they could ever bottle him, he'd outsell ginger ale.
Ready, Mr. Amiel.
Oh, thanks, Tibby. Mr. Bartlow, Georgia, let me read your script. It's a beautiful job. I'd like to talk about your next one when you're ready.
Thank you. Well, goodbye, Georgia.
Goodbye.
Nice to have met you.
Bye.
Shooting started on the proud land, and everything went well until the fourth day. Then something happened.
Cut!
Actors in Old South costumes sit around the elegant dining room set. Between takes, director Von Elstein peers at an actress through an eyepiece, then frames her face with his hands.
Say, oh, Mr. Von Elstein! Could you come here, please?
Von Elstein, a sharp-featured man with thin, graying hair, strides past the dining table where crew members and equipment stand just off the set. Jonathan takes him aside.
Mr. Von Elstein, am I to understand that you consider this scene complete?
I do.
Well, I don't.
You call that directing? That is what I've been calling it for 32 years.
Are there values and dimensions in that scene you haven't begun to hit?
Perhaps they're not the values and dimensions I wish to hit. I could make this scene a climax. I could make every scene in this picture a climax. If I did, I would be a bad director. And I like to think of myself as one of the best. A picture or climaxes is like a necklace without a string. It falls apart. You must build to your big moments. And sometimes you must build slowly.
Look, when I want a lecture on the aesthetics of motion pictures, I'll ask for it. And it won't be on my time, and it won't be a cover-up for a shallow and inept interpretation of a great scene. To be a director, you must have imagination.
Whose imagination, Mr. Shields? Yours or mine? There is only one answer to that. You see this picture one way, and I another. It will be done your way, but not by me, and not by any other director who respects himself. You know what you must do, Mr. Shields, so that you will have it exactly as you want it? You must direct this picture yourself.
Von Elstein's eyes fix in a piercing glare.
To direct a picture, a man needs humility. Do you have humility, Mr. Shields?
The director walks out. Later, imitation snow falls on a soldier carrying a torn battle flag.
Jonathan, the director, was a new Jonathan. He was patience personified. He was tolerant, even-tempered, considerate, and indulgent to his crew, his cast, and his writing.
In a different scene, Jonathan directs a Confederate officer who kisses a Southern belle. Another day, rebels run past a bonfire blazing inside a soundstage. Later, in the screening room, Harry Pebble watches the film with other studio staff.
Six months and 4 days after he started shooting, we saw the picture put together for the first time.
Nice job of cutting, Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Shields.
Jonathan sits with Jim in the second row.
Thanks.
Beautiful production. Beautifully written, Jim. Beautifully produced. Harry, tell Chapman his photography's perfect.
Beautiful. Wonderful, stuff. Wasn't it? Beautiful.
And congratulate Walter on his sets, Lucian on her costumes, and Boris on his score.
Yeah, I like the music.
And tell the director he should have his head examined. He shouldn't have shot the picture. He should have shot himself.
Jonathan, it's not as bad as all that.
I butchered it. Von Elstein should have been here today. He would have enjoyed this.
I have no tension, no timing, no pace, nothing. I took a beautiful, sensitive story and turned it into a turgid, boring movie. For anyone else's direction, I'd never release the picture. I'd shelve it. Who's got a cigarette? Anybody got my thing?
Here you are.
Thanks, Harry. I've made pictures that lost money, but they had something. This is nothing.
Oh, Jonathan, you're being drastic. I'm sure.
Look, all you've got to do is cut that dead wood out of the center of this picture. We can go on.
Harry, shelve the picture.
Shelve it?
Shelve the picture? Are you crazy? We can't do that.
Why not?
Look, Jonathan, we're a hawk to the banks up to our necks. We went away over budget. We've got to release it.
Harry, there's your penny-pinching mind again. Shelve it.
We shelve it, and that's the end of Shields production. Goodbye to 17 years' work. Goodbye to every dime you've got.
How about the money in the sock?
There isn't any sock. Your last two pictures, and this one took care of that. And every dime of mine is gone, and every dime of Sid's.
That I didn't know.
The banks turned us down on the money for the last retakes. Sid and I, well, you were shooting, and who could bother you then?
A hard-headed businessman. The hard-boiled press agent. I still won't release a picture of mine that I know is bad.
But, Jonathan, other men do.
Their pictures don't say Jonathan Shields presents.
Okay. What story shall I break?
That's easy. Jonathan Shields lays an egg.
Later, in Jonathan's office, Jim pours a drink. Chomping his pipe, he carries the glass to Jonathan, sitting in a leather armchair.
What are you going to do now?
I'm tired, Jim.
What are you going to do now?
You mind changing the subject? I just played my big scene in there, The Great Man Fails. What do you want, an encore?
You sound like Sebastian.
Who? Oh, your new book.
You told me once to never let a leading character feel sorry for himself. Not for long.
I was wrong. It's very comforting to feel sorry for yourself.
You're coming with me.
What?
I've taken a cabin up at Tahoe. I'm going to finish my new book. And you're coming along.
Why?
Well, why not? Besides, I work better when you're around.
Can you wait a while?
How long?
5 minutes. It'll take me that long to pack.
He goes into a washroom.
Say, you know, that Sebastian of yours sounds like a great character. You'll have trouble casting him.
This is a book, not a movie.
You'll sell it to pictures, and they'll have trouble casting it. Gee, the things Gaucho could have done with that part. You know, he was Sebastian, the guy with the world on a string. The big, happy baboon. I begged him, don't take that plane, Gaucho, but... No, not him, he...
Cleaning his pipe, Jim stiffens. Jonathan steps slowly out of the bathroom with a haunted stare.
Today's my day for mistakes. Jim, I didn't kill Rosemary. Gaucho didn't kill her. She killed herself.
Jim belts him.
Whether you like it or not, you're better off. She was a fool. She got in your way. She interfered with your work. She wasted your time. She wasted you. You're better off without her.
Jim walks out. Now, gray-haired Harry Pebble holds a book. James Lee Bartlow's A Woman of Taste.
The sensitive, unforgettable portrait of a present-day Southern belle. Gay and foolish. Naive, shrewd, and heartbreaking all at once. Yes, Jim, Jonathan sure destroyed you. You came out of it with nothing. Nothing but a Pulitzer Prize novel... The highest salary of any writer in Hollywood. Look, folks, you've got to give the devil his due. We all owe him something, and you know it. And you've had plenty of years to think it over.
What do you owe him, Harry?
Plenty. All the times he told me to shut my penny-pinching mouth. To Jonathan, I was always just an overpaid bookkeeper.
But without him, I probably would still be putting costumes on Catman. You know, when they list the 10 best pictures ever made, there are always two or three of his in the list. And I was with him when he made them. Excuse me.
Yes?
Your call from Paris is ready.
Oh. Hello? Hello? Yes, Jonathan.
Jim, Georgia, and Fred exchange cautious glances.
Yes, they're here. Uh-huh, all three of them. All right, I'll ask them.
Jonathan wants to know, will you help him get started again? Will you work with him just this once? Will you do this picture with him?
Jim slowly shakes his head.
Georgia?
She stubs out her cigarette and stands up. They all walk out.
Sorry, Jonathan. No, I can't.
I'm sorry, Jonathan. They're gone.
I'm sure it's a great idea, but Jonathan... Jonathan, this is costing $4.80 a minute. Don't tell me your idea. Write me. Jonathan.
In the outer office, Georgia stops and gazes anxiously at an extension phone. Lifting the receiver, she holds it to her ear and nervously fingers the cord.
Rough. Yeah.
Her eyes widen behind her netted veil, then her brow creases. As she listens, Fred leans in. Georgia moves the receiver between them. Now Jim cocks his chin over Georgia's shoulder. He frowns and taps the back of her hand, and she switches the phone over again. The three huddle together, listening in the fading light. The scene dissolves and words appear. The end. The Bad and the Beautiful, made in Hollywood, USA, by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. This film has been described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, WGBH Boston. Described by Robin Sitton. Descriptions read by Margot Stage. Funding provided by the United States Department of Education. Now, credits appear beside their characters. Gilbert Roland as Gaucho. Gloria Graham as Rosemary. Barry Sullivan as Fred. Walter Pidgeon as Harry Pebble. Dick Powell as James Lee. Kirk Douglas as Jonathan. Lana Turner as Georgia. A message. We are grateful to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences for permission to use the Academy Award statuette.